Les colloques du Collège de France.
Bonjour, bonjour à toutes et à tous. Bienvenue à ce colloque aujourd'hui où je ne parle pas et où nous allons écouter des interventions des académiques, des professeurs, surtout du Royaume-Uni, mais aussi de Vienne, de la Roumanie, de l'Italie. Et c'est un colloque qui va se dérouler en anglais. J'espère que vous savez ça. Il va avoir un enregistrement sur YouTube et là peut-être il va avoir aussi la possibilité de voir les sous-titres en français. Je commence par introduire notre premier professeur. It's Professor Jan Candiali from the University of Durham. He's associate professor in political theory and works on a variety of topics in social and political philosophy, and has just published a book with Oxford University Press on Marx and the idea of human flourishing. Today he's going to talk to us about three socialist criticisms of liberalism. Jan, the floor is yours.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Leah. Very, very kind introduction. Thank you very much for the invitation. It's a great pleasure to be here today in this wonderful venue and with a great group of political philosophers talking about the relationship between liberalism and socialism. So as Leah said, my talk today is called Three Socialist Criticisms of Liberalism. And what I'm going to do in the talk, very simply, is to distinguish three different criticisms that socialists, I think historically and in contemporary political philosophy, make of liberalism and offer a kind of critical evaluation of the merits and the strength of each of those criticisms. So the first criticism that I'm going to talk about is the criticism that liberalism permits significant forms of distributive unfairness. And I'll explain that I think that was a good criticism of classical forms of liberalism, of the liberalism of someone like John Locke, but it doesn't really have force against the best versions of liberal egalitarianism. And the failure of this first critique has, I think, led many socialists in contemporary political philosophy, including, I think, some of the speakers later today, to adopt a second critique. And this is a kind of internal, or for Hegelians, a kind of immanent critique of liberalism. It starts off with the idea that liberals and socialists basically share the same set of values, values like freedom, values like equality. And liberals go awry, according to this criticism, when they think about what sort of social, political, and economic institutions are necessary to bring those values about. In particular, they go wrong in thinking that these values are compatible with a capitalist organization of the economy. Okay, so that's the second criticism. And I think that's a good criticism. I think it has force even against the best versions of liberal egalitarianism. But one thing I want to do in the talk is to encourage socialists to also develop a third critique. And the third critique is, I think, a kind of, again, another historically influential socialist critique. And it relies on the idea that there are some distinctly kind of socialist values and theoretical commitments that liberals either overlook or at least undervalue in their kind of deliberations, fail to give kind of sufficient weight to. And what I'll do in that part of the talk is outline three candidates about what those socialist values might be, the first of which I think doesn't really work, but I think there are two kind of promising candidates for distinctly socialist values that I'll talk about. So the broad aim of the talk is twofold. First of all, to provide a kind of helpful taxonomy, a kind of schema for understanding different socialist criticisms of liberalism. But also, as I've just indicated, I want to make the case that socialists shouldn't stop at this second critique, as I think there is a bit of a tendency to do within contemporary socialist thought. They should embrace the idea that there is some distinctly fundamental socialist values. Two qualifications before I start the main part of the talk. So first of all, I'm not saying that these criticisms exhaust kind of socialist criticisms of liberalism. I think there are criticisms that fall outside of the taxonomy that I provide here and that have been historically important. Happy to talk about those in the Q&A. Also, the criticisms are not mutually exclusive. So that is to say, it's possible and I think it's probably desirable to develop these criticisms simultaneously. And if one thinks about some of the kind of key socialist thinkers, historically or in contemporary political philosophy, I think they've done that. Okay, I think they've tended to develop those criticisms kind of in tandem. Okay, so let's turn now then to the first part of the talk, focusing on this criticism of distributive unfairness. So as I've said, one common socialist criticism of liberalism is that it permits significant forms of distributive unfairness. And there are many different ways that socialists historically have made that criticism, but perhaps the most influential way is to draw a distinction between two different types of freedom, between real freedom on the one hand and formal freedom on the other. So roughly by this distinction, I mean something as follows. So I enjoy the formal freedom to come to Paris to give this talk if, for example, there are no legal barriers preventing me from exiting the UK and entering France. But real freedom requires more than that. Real freedom requires both that I have the legal rights to leave the UK and enter France, but also that I have the various means at my disposal to actually, you know, pay for a ticket to do that, to stay at a hotel when I'm here, to buy meals, and so on and so forth. And the crux of the socialist criticism of liberalism here is that liberalism has just been concerned with formal freedom and has therefore overlooked the ways that material inequalities, distributive unfairness, and poverty has undermined people's real freedom, right? It's undermined the real freedom. Now, as I've already said, I think this is a very good criticism of classical forms of liberalism. It's a good criticism of Lockean liberalism. It's a good criticism, I think, of the libertarianism of someone like Robert Nozick. However, I don't think it has much purchase against the best forms of liberal egalitarianism. So if you consider what I take to be the best form of liberal egalitarianism, which is John Rawls's work, A Theory of Justice, we can see that Rawls has various kind of safeguards in place, various kind of institutional and theoretical commitments that enable him to address, I think, that socialist complaint. So just to give you a flavour of these, Rawls doesn't think we just have, for example, a right to vote or a formal right to political freedom. He emphasises the fair value of the political liberties. He says that all citizens, whatever their social position, may be assured a fair opportunity to exert political influence. Similarly, Rawls doesn't just require formal equality of opportunity, he requires fair equality of opportunity. He thinks that citizens who have the same kind of talents, the same motivation to develop their talents, to deploy them, should enjoy an equal chance of obtaining valuable social and economic resources. And finally, and perhaps most famously, Rawls, of course, is willing to tolerate some degree of economic inequality, some inequality in income and wealth, but he's only willing to tolerate that on the very stringent condition that those inequalities are to the maximal benefit of the least advantaged group in society. So that's a very stringent requirement on economic inequality. So for all those reasons, in purely kind of distributive terms, I think there's not that much room to the left of liberal egalitarianism for socialism to stake out a position. And I think generally attempts to develop a socialist theory of justice to the left of Rawls have generally been unsuccessful. A note of caution, I think this doesn't mean that liberalism has triumphed over socialism, even on this particular level. And I think this is a narrative that you see in some parts within contemporary political philosophy. It's a narrative I detect a bit in Will Kimlicker's book, Contemporary Political Philosophy, but also in some of Joseph Heath's recent writings about the relationship between liberalism and Marxism. So I think that triumphant narrative is wrong for two reasons. First of all, it's wrong because while it's true that liberal egalitarianism has moved, can accommodate socialist criticisms now, that is precisely because liberal egalitarianism has moved in the direction of socialism, taking on board its critique of poverty, of material inequality, and the way that undermines people's real freedom. So if anything, this is a win for socialism, I think. Right? But the second reason why the triumphant narrative, I think, is wrong is that socialists have other criticisms of liberalism at their disposal. And it's these two other criticisms that I'm going to focus on now. Okay, so owing to that kind of failure of that first criticism, Many socialists within contemporary political philosophy have moved to this second criticism,
which, as I said, is an internal critique. So the internal critique starts with this idea that basically liberals and socialists are closer together than we might commonly think. Liberals and socialists basically share the same set of fundamental values. In particular, they both share a commitment to freedom and to equality, and to securing the conditions of everybody's freedom within society. The criticism then goes on to say that where liberals and socialists differ is in their view of the kind of society and the kind of social, economic, and political institutions that are necessary to bring those values about. So whereas liberals think it's possible to enjoy freedom and equality in a kind of suitably regulated form of capitalism, socialists deny that fact. Socialists say it's only possible to enjoy the freedom and equality that liberalism prizes in a socialist society, in a society that has abolished private ownership of the means of production. So on this view, liberalism and socialism are quite close together in terms of theoretical commitments, in terms of fundamental values. What they have is a kind of empirical disagreement about institutions. And socialism might there be seen as a kind of heir to liberalism, as kind of fully realising liberal values that liberals themselves have been unable to realise so far. So here are just a few quotations that illustrate this kind of line of thought. So first of all, a quotation from Leia. Leia says in a recent essay, The Politics of Reticent Socialism, there is no huge gap between liberal egalitarianism and socialism if we ask what justice requires from an impartial moral perspective. But the demands of justice as fairness, rules this theory of justice, cannot be realised by liberal political institutions. Okay. Similarly, here's Tony Smith, an American philosopher who was at Ohio State for a long time, in a book, which I think has been neglected somewhat, called Beyond Liberal Egalitarianism. Smith says, the normative commitments underlying Marxian social theory and those elaborated by liberal egalitarians broadly coincide. There's no need to go beyond liberal egalitarianism in this important dimension. Where Smith does think it's important to go beyond liberal egalitarianism is precisely in the kind of account of capitalism that liberals provide. So these are both two kind of reasonably new views within political philosophy, but I take it this internal critique is actually much older than that. So here's Edward Bernstein, a kind of key figure in the Second International. Bernstein says, some moderation should be kept in the declaration of the war against liberalism. It's true that the great liberal movements of modern times arose for the advantage of the capitalist, but with respect to liberalism as a great historical movement, socialism is its legitimate heir, not only in chronological sequence, but also in terms of its spiritual qualities. Right? So again, there I think we have a much more conciliatory understanding of the relationship between liberalism and socialism. Okay, so just to sketch a kind of argument here. So one thought here is, why do socialists think that freedom and equality are impossible under capitalism? So I think there are a number of different arguments that socialists might appeal to here, but I think the simplest argument, and perhaps the most effective, appeals to the simple fact of wage labour. So the basic thought, I take it, is this. If you were born into a working class family, or if you're born into a family without very significant amounts of family wealth, then effectively you're compelled to work for the duration of your adult life. Right? There's a kind of basic compulsion to labour. But not only are you compelled to work, once you're at work, you're also then under the thumb of your employer. You're subject to their kind of personal choices while you're at work. So there's a kind of basic form of domination that's kind of woven into the economy. But of course, there's not a kind of equal liability of all to labour here, because there are some people who, because they have significant amounts of wealth, are neither compelled to work in the way that the vast majority of people are, nor, therefore, are they under the thumb of their employer while at work. So they avoid altogether the kind of domination that socialists see as kind of inherent in the economy. So I take it the criticism here is that the modern economy is characterized by this kind of asymmetrical subordination, a subordination between those who have wealth on the one hand and those who lack it on the other. Historically, the criticism says, liberalism, to its great credit, has been very sensitive to political forms of domination. but it's basically turned a blind eye to wage labour and to the economy, and therefore has overlooked this kind of economic domination, which is just kind of baked into the capitalist economy. So on this view, to use a nice phrase of Lukas Stanchik's, most liberals so far have only really been marginal liberals. They've only had a marginal commitment to liberal values. Socialists on this view offer a much kind of more full-blooded, thoroughgoing commitment to liberalism than liberals themselves do. Okay, so I think this criticism is basically correct. Right? I'm going to say something less positive about it in a minute, but I think this criticism is correct. I think it has force against the best forms of liberal egalitarianism, unlike the first critique. And in particular, I think it has two virtues. Strategically, I think it makes sense. So, especially within political philosophy, liberalism is the kind of dominant political ideology, whereas socialism is something of an outlier still, I think. And therefore, it makes sense for socialists to focus on points of overlap with liberalism in order to, you know, get their points heard. I think that kind of motivation is quite central, for example, to some of Leia's writings in the essay I quoted earlier. But philosophically, I think it has a merit too. So internal critique is often thought by philosophers to be a particularly powerful form of critique. So with internal critique, you're not criticizing your opponent according to some external standard that they themselves may reject. You're showing how the very principles that your opponent espouses in fact lead to your own position. Right? So in this case, you're showing how the very values of freedom and equality that liberals cherish in fact lead to a socialist organization of the economy when their implications are thought through properly. Right? So it's a particularly powerful form of critique. But at the same time, I find there to be something unsatisfying about this critique when that is thought to be the kind of whole story about what socialism is about. So I think one thing that I find unsatisfying about it is it tends to reduce the disagreement between liberals and socialists to a disagreement about empirics. And therefore, in doing so, it gives up on the idea that socialists have some distinctive fundamental values of their own, which liberals themselves may not share, or at least to the same degree. And I think that's not true. I think socialists do have some theoretical commitments that liberals don't share, but I also think it makes sense for socialists to make that point, strategically speaking. Okay, so this is just the final part of the talk. I'm going to talk a little bit about this socialist values critique. So as I said, the third criticism is this idea, which follows on from the second critique, that there might be some distinctly socialist values that liberalism overlooks or undervalues. And I think there are a number of different candidates about what those values might be, and I'll just talk about three very quickly. So historically, I think the leading candidate for a socialist value was the value of equality. So here's Hugh Gaitskell, former Labour Chancellor of the Exchequer, leader of the opposition. Socialism, Gaitskell said, is about equality. Right? He was there trying to detach socialism from a commitment to collective ownership of the means of production and say it's much more about a commitment to equality. So I take it that the kind of Gaitskell's view here is something like this. It's a common view that you hear, that liberals basically, in the clash between liberty and equality, they give priority to liberty, and socialists give priority to equality over liberty. So I think that's wrong. I think that's a mistake. I think it's a mistake for one reason I've already indicated. Liberal egalitarians have a serious commitment to equality, so it's not a fair characterization, I think, of Rawls or perhaps of Dworkin to say that they put freedom over equality. That seems to me the wrong way to characterize their view. It's also wrong, I think, for socialists because it means that you're ceding freedom to liberalism. And both strategically and philosophically, I think that's a mistake. It's a mistake strategically because people care about freedom. It's a mistake philosophically because I think for many socialists, freedom really is a kind of very important value, arguably more important than equality. So I think that's not right. But there are two other candidates I just want to flesh out. One more promising candidate is some idea of positive freedom as collective self-government. And I see this kind of idea of collective self-government perhaps in some of the speakers who'll be talking today. So I think some of Chiara Cordelli's recent work, some of Gabrielle Warner's work, is relying on values that are in the vicinity of something that I'm talking about here. So I take it that the rough idea here is, just as there is value in individuals being the author of their own life, There's also value in collectives being the author, collectively speaking, of their lives. There's value in us collectively organizing our life together. Capitalism subverts that value in some ways. Socialism, by giving us control over investment, by giving us control over production, would facilitate that value. Historically, I think this has definitely been an important part of socialism. Here's a quotation from Engels. Engels says, "The transition to socialism is the ascent of man from the kingdom of necessity to the kingdom of freedom." It's a kind of Kantian language. Man, at last the master of his own form of social organization, right, unlike capitalism, becomes at the same time the lord over nature, his own master, free. So the idea is there, it's not just that we're non-subjected to other people's choices, it's not just a norm of non-domination, it goes beyond that. We're our own masters, we're kind of collectively self-determining. By contrast, I think, liberals have tended historically to be sceptical about ideas of collective freedom. They certainly think there's value in individuals authoring their own life, there's value in individual autonomy, but they're sceptical about the idea that collectives can do this. You see this scepticism, for example, Niko Kolodny's recent work on democracy. Kolodny thinks that democracy is valuable because it realizes a norm of non-subordination, but he doesn't think, and he's sceptical of the idea, that it realizes an idea of social freedom or autonomy. So I take it that one virtue of this approach is that it's easy to draw a link between the value, on the one hand, collective self-determination, and socialist economic and political arrangements on the other. Once we think that the key value of socialism is collective self-determination, it seems as though planning and economic democracy is going to be, you know, very closely connected to the realization of those values. I take it that the challenge for this view, which I'm sympathetic to, is showing, that's to say I'm sympathetic to the view, not necessarily the challenge, the challenge I take it for the view is showing how something like collective self-government can be realized on a very large scale. So we know that small-scale clubs and associations might realize this idea. It's harder to see how society as a whole might do that. Okay, I'm just going to talk about one further candidate. So in the remainder of the talk, I want to talk about a different version of the socialist values critique, not a competitor, I don't think, to it, but just a different version. And it's one that's based on my reading of the early Marx, or the young Marx, in a book that Leah mentioned, Flourishing Together, Karl Marx's Vision of the Good Society. So excuse the self-promotion. A more humble thing to say here is that similar ideas here have been developed by other people. So not only Marx scholars like David Leopold, Daniel Brodny, but also in political philosophy, people like Paul Gomberg, his book How to Make Opportunity Equal, Barry Maguire at the University of Edinburgh, and also in some of Jerry Cohen, G.A. Cohen's work, in particular his kind of critique of the market in his last book, Why Not Socialism? So on the view that I'm interested in and have been developing, there are kind of two key socialist values. So one of the values is the idea of self-realization in work, right? The idea of self-realization in work. And the other key value is solidarity with other people. And I think Marx, at least on my reading, puts these values together in the following way. Self-realization in work involves realizing oneself, right? That's kind of the self-realizing part, through providing other people with the goods and services they need to pursue their flourishing. So if you want to, you know, see how the values fit together, the thought is, I achieve my self-realization by acting in a solidaristic manner towards others, right? And we're trying to live in a society that has as its shared goal the idea that everyone can have such self-realization. The thought here then is that capitalism in a variety of ways thwarts these values. It thwarts the value of self-realization in work by giving rise to very intense but maybe not meaningful forms of production. It thwarts the value of solidarity by pitting people against one another in market competition. Whereas socialism, by overcoming or at least limiting the market, would facilitate those values. So I suppose one question here for this view is, how far can liberalism accommodate these values, which I take, I haven't provided an argument for it here, which I take to be attractive. I hope that they kind of resonate. So can liberalism accommodate the values that I'm talking about self-realization and solidarity? So one, I think, obstacle for liberals to adopt such a view would be anti-perfectionism or neutrality. So by this, I mean the view, here's a kind of canonical statement from Ronald Dworkin, who alongside Rawls probably one of the most important liberal egalitarians of the 20th century, is the idea that government must be neutral on what might be called the question of the good life. So the government, the state, shouldn't take a view on what is kind of meaningful in people's lives. By contrast, the socialist view I've articulated is perfectionist. It's not neutral about what the good life is. It's got a distinctive conception of what a good life is, as involving self-realization in work and solidarity. So it's morally not neutral, but it's also politically non-neutral, because it says that we should arrange our social, economic, political institutions so as to facilitate those values, self-realization and solidarity. Here it might be said, I suppose, just as a final thought, the association of liberalism and neutrality, which is very strong in Dworkin and in particularly in the later Rawls, is a relatively recent kind of amalgam of views. For much of its history, liberalism has not been anti-perfectionist or neutral. So the liberalism of John Stuart Mill or of T.H. Green, for example, was also explicitly perfectionist. So there are perfectionist forms of liberalism that might be closer, perhaps in spirit, to the view that I'm articulating. But there is another way I think that the view clashes with certain liberal commitments. As I kind of articulated, the view that I sketched requires everyone to have a real, that is not to say not a merely equal opportunity, a real opportunity, such that everyone who wants it can have it, for self-realization in work. Right? It requires everyone to have that real opportunity. And in my view, this requires us to share the socially necessary drudgery that's involved in maintaining society over time. So if there's burdensome work that's involved in, providing services that people need, and those can't be vehicles for self-realization, they should be shared between people. Now, this kind of sharing, which I think is central to the realization of both self-realization, because it's by sharing that labor that we can all have self-realization, and it's also, I think, central to the realization of solidarity, because the sharing of burdens isn't, in a way, a paradigmatic form of solidarity. That sharing is, I think, inconsistent with the priority that many liberals give to certain basic liberties. So Rawls gives priority to certain basic liberties, freedom of occupation, most obviously, but also freedom of movement, freedom of association. And Rawls, therefore, and I think for other liberals, would partly rule that out, maybe on the view out on anti-perfectionist grounds, but also rule that out in terms of this commitment to freedom, to the basic liberties. And I suppose the thought here is then that the priority that liberals give to these basic liberties prevents them from engaging in a kind of critique of and reorganization of the division of labor in society. And therefore, it really undermines the opportunity to achieve self-realization in work and solidarity with others, two values that I've argued are central to socialism. So for those two reasons, while I think some liberals are attracted to ideas of solidarity and self-realization in work, Rawls certainly is, I think there are other theoretical commitments that liberals tend to have which undermines their capacity to actually put them into practice. Okay, so very quick conclusion then, because I think I'm slightly over time already. So I've distinguished three different criticisms of liberalism. A criticism which says liberalism permits distributive unfairness, a criticism which is an internal critique, liberalism and socialism share the same values but disagree about the society that's necessary to realise those values, and liberals are naive in thinking that we can have freedom and equality under capitalism, and the idea that there are some distinctly socialist values, maybe collective self-government, maybe solidarity and self-realisation in work. I've argued that one doesn't really have any force against the best versions of liberal egalitarianism, so I don't think there's much room to the left of liberalism in distributive terms. I think the second criticism it has purchase, and many socialists have, I think, adopted that second criticism for those reasons. And I suppose the talk has partly been a plea that socialists don't give up on the third critique. Okay, thanks very much.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.